Welcome to UFO Think Tank Radio with your host, Alejandro Rojas.
Hola, hola, Coca-Cola. It's Alejandro Rojas, and you're listening to UFO Think Tank Radio. I want to thank you once again for returning. It's always delightful to talk to you and to have you back again. You're just beautiful, beautiful people, and I'm so happy to have you here every week. We have a very interesting show today. I have an author who we will be speaking with named Frank Fascino Jr., and this is a gentleman who actually wrote a book a few years ago about the Flatwoods Monster, which, of course, sounds kind of crazy. Sounds like a 50s B-movie, and it was a real-life 50s incident, fairly famous in UFO research circles, this incident where this craft was seen to seemingly land in a forest in West Virginia. A woman along with some children went out to go look, and they saw some strange robotic or witch type of creature. Very strange. That may jog some memories, but you may not know the details. And I'm sure you do not know the details as much as Frank does, because Frank studied this thing for a long time. Now, his book that came out in 2004, he was not very happy with. The publisher, I guess, took the liberty to make some changes. They deleted some of the work, changed some of the work as to make it inaccurate. So he was awfully embarrassed because he did have the famous ufologist, the man who discovered Roswell, Stanton Friedman, write the foreword for it, and Stanton liked the book, and a lot of people have said, well, you know, there's a lot of mistakes in there and everything, and he says, I know, I'm sorry, it wasn't my fault, and so he is reprinting the book, and it should be out any day now. You can go to flatwoodsmonster.com, and he's got plenty of stuff there on the website for you to look at, including eyewitness testimony photographs, which are more... There's one famous photograph people see often with this case, and it's a picture that was drawn by a media person, a news person, and they took a little liberty, I guess, in the picture. And so he has gotten with the witnesses, and they have taken some more time to more carefully and accurately depict what they had seen, and it's very strange. You'll see for yourself if you go to the site, and you'll hear about it in just a few minutes. So very interesting case, and we're going to hear all about it. And one thing that's so great is that these guys were kids, you know, when this happened. So most of them are still alive, and their story is the same. It doesn't change, and they talk about the same thing they talked about back then when it happened. So eyewitness testimony, multiple witnesses, that doesn't get much better than that, unfortunately, because what would be better? Some video. You know, if they had their iPhones with them and captured these guys on video or something, that'd be cool. But, of course, then people would think that was fake. But at least it would give some of us who would realize that it's real some more data to work with to understand what the heck is going on. Although this is case, like so many others, is so enigmatic and strange and crazy and zany. That's one of the things that gives it a ring of truth often, I don't know that it does help us figure anything out, because it's nothing like anything that's happened before, and that, which is the way it is so often, as we've talked about many times on the show. Strange strangeness in a strange world. Speaking of strange, there's this area on Huffington Post called Weird News. There's a couple, there's a great writer, Lee Spiegel, writes for it, and you probably think I'm going to be talking about one of his stories, because I usually do, but I'm not, because his latest story hasn't come out yet. although I know a little bit of what it's about, and I'm going to talk about that in a second. But there's a blogger on there named Alejandro Rojas. That is I, ladies and gentlemen, and I did a new blog about the Navajo Rangers. Of course, if you have been a listener for only a few short months at least, then you heard not too long ago I interviewed a couple of the Rangers who are trained by the feds. They're almost federal agents themselves who do law enforcement on the Navajo Nation. And they also roll for paranormal. So, like, if people call and say, hey, man, there's a Bigfoot in my backyard, get out here and get this guy out of here. These guys are going to roll in and check it out and negotiate with the Bigfoot to leave the gentleman's land. Unfortunately, they haven't had anything that exciting, although they have investigated Bigfoot sightings. But the point being that they would, you know, if someone called, they would roll in and try to negotiate some peace with the Bigfoot. But the point is that they take all calls seriously, including the paranormal ones, and they will go out and investigate those. And they have had some very, very interesting UFO and paranormal cases. And so I did a blog post about that because they've been on the local CBS here in Arizona, but it hasn't really been that national news what they do. And I think they're cool guys. They're my heroes. I mean, how cool is that to be law enforcement and go check these out? Talk about real-life X-Files, but even better because it's Navajo Nation, the Southwest. I'm a Southwest man. I'm all about the Southwest. And there's nothing, you know, some of my favorite books growing up were these ones, Tony Hillerman books, where this Navajo police officer was the protagonist. And these guys are the real deal. And even better than Tony Hillerman books, which are great, these guys are looking into paranormal stuff. So I'm very excited about what these guys do. Plus, they're really cool, nice guys. And then plus, if you remember the show, I went night sky watching with these guys, and they brought some of their great night vision equipment. And John Dover and I and a couple other people we were with had a sighting of something very strange that I cannot explain to this day. Wow, just thinking about it. What the heck was that, man? So you can go listen to the show with John Dover and hear us talk about that. And there is an Open Minds video here, too, because they interviewed these guys. I got to meet them when they came to speak to Arizona MUFON in Phoenix. And so then I got to meet with those guys. And then I want to shout out to my Tucson buddies because I helped restart some MUFON in Tucson. And so we had a meeting yesterday in Tucson, and that was a lot of fun. We had nearly 30 people, somewhere between 25 and 30 people there, which was great because I thought it'd be, you know, five or six since we're just getting started again. But a pretty good turnout, so hopefully that will persist and we will get more people and we'll have many of the professors from the UNA come and help us figure all this stuff out. That would be wonderful, wouldn't it? A lot of astronomy done out of the University of Arizona, which is there in Tucson, which is exciting. So lots of exciting things. This show's always so exciting. That's why I say exciting, exciting, exciting all of the time. It's exciting. Speaking of exciting, Britain. Some people think that the Brits are boring, and some of them probably are, but not all of them. But the MOD is, because they're not investigating UFOs anymore. Of course, we already know this, so I'm a little perplexed as to why this story is coming out right now. But the Telegraph, one of the respected papers there in the UK, not like The Sun or The Daily Mail, which are kind of tabloidish. But this one is one of their bigger papers. They wrote about how the MOD is not investigating UFOs. Now, we know that because you've listened to the show, and in 2009, they said they closed down their UFO desk, and they're like, don't call us anymore about UFOs, guys, because we don't care. And they had a statement up on the site. Somehow, in an interview, recently with an air traffic control. The topic of UFOs came up, and the guy in charge of air traffic control in the UK said, we do get reports by air traffic control at least once a month of UFOs, things we see we can't explain. But the MOD doesn't care, and they're not investigating. And so they asked the MOD, and they confirmed and said, yeah, we don't care. Do they really care? Is there really something going on that they're just, you know, just kind of doing on the hush-hush in the background? Maybe. But that's what this story is about, is that they essentially said that in 50 years of having the UFO desk open and doing investigations, they haven't found evidence of any potential threat to the UK, which, you know, it's true. Anybody in this field, and the United States Air Force is kind of, or at least different groups have said something similar. I mean, the Air Force first closed the UFO files because they said there was nothing, there's no scientific gain to investigating UFOs. And then you often see that there are no threats. It doesn't pose a national defense issue, or like they say in the UK, issue. Which is kind of weird. Issue. There's no national defense issue in caused by UFOs. Of course, some people are saying if there's something flying around up there and we don't know what it is, isn't that kind of scary and possible threat? Well, they're saying, well, you know, sure, there's something flying around. We don't know what it is, but it's not hurting nobody, so let's leave it alone. I guess it's their story. But it is interesting that, you know, they don't come out and say that there's no phenomena here. Because they admit that they get at least one anomalous event a month. So really interesting story, but somehow they're not going to do anything about it. They said it also kind of breaks up their two groups, because they do have a group that looks at for ballistic missiles, something like that. And so that's what they're telling people. Interesting story, huh? Yeah, I thought so too. And other news. And this is what Lee, I know, is going to write about soon. I'm giving you a little preview because I guess he hasn't posted his story yet. But is some of the Mars videos and stuff. And there is a video out there. And if you go to, of course, UFODailyNews.com, you're going to have to look at the Twitter feed for this one. But that's okay. Just click on the news feed and you'll see a link for it. A video of on Mars of Curiosity. And one of the videos, it's kind of weird. You do see what looks to be some kind of little white dot go float up, and then another one kind of cruising across the horizon. WTF is what I'm saying. What the flip, man? Because there shouldn't be anything floating around up there. Of course, if this was on Earth, you could think that maybe it's just a something floating around, you know, something like that, or a bug, or a bird, or maybe that's what it was, a space bug, a Martian bug. But, of course, if that is the case, that is big news, and that's pretty cool. So maybe they'll make the announcement soon. Bugs in space. Mars has bugs. And it may. You know, it'd be the first life, though, that we discovered off of our own humble little planet. And that would be exciting. So it is a very interesting video, I must say. And I have seen some people with some possible suggestions and comments on the story, but nothing that seems too plausible yet. Something blowing in the wind, I don't know. It's very, very interesting. So we'll have to follow this some more, and we'll have to see what Lee found out. Maybe he hasn't posted his story because it's big, and NASA says, hey, we're going to let you post this story about how you know, this is life and you broke this open. And I know there's some interesting stuff, other interesting stuff Lee's going to have in there. So you have to wait for that story. Until then, go check out this video because it is very interesting, I think. We've got a very long interview with Frank with lots of stuff to talk about. So actually, we're probably going to go over 5 minutes. So if you're listening live to the blog talk, you have to listen to the recording later because live kind of cuts me off right on time what the podcast will go over if we go over, which often we do actually go a minute or two over. So, which is just fine because we've just got so much cool stuff that we have a hard time fitting it into an hour and a half, right? So, let's talk with Frank because he's got some very interesting discoveries from the 50s. I am very excited to have our next guest on the show, and that is Frank Fascino Jr. Hello, how are you?
Hi, Alejandro. Glad to be here.
Yep, thank you so much. I'm glad you were able to join us. So this is exciting. You have a new version of your old book coming out, but a better, new and improved and better than ever version of your book, The Braxton County Monster, the cover-up of the Flatwoods Monster Revealed.
Well, that was my original book that was published in 2004,
mm-hmm.
and here we are about 8 years later, and the story can finally be told in its entirety and its correct version, and with tons of new updates and new information, government documents. We're ready to go on this one. So this is should be the first book that tells the entire untold story of what happened on September 12, 1952.
Great. Very exciting. I can't wait to see the book. Now, some people will recall that, as you said, that this book had come out earlier, but I don't think a lot of people know because I've seen some references. In fact, James Mosley, I think in the latest version of his saucer smear had mentioned the book, but some don't know that book was kind of mauled by the last publisher, so it really didn't represent all of the research or the way you wanted it to.
Not at all. What had happened, in a nutshell, basically, is I was working with the publisher, and the book was being edited, and I was working along with them on the changes. Some of them I agreed with, some of them I disagreed. And we were going along for a stretch there for a while. And what happened is when the book finally went into print, I was not told nor notified in any way, shape, or form that the book went into another drastic edit and it was shortened. And basically what happened, to tell you the truth, is I went on book tour and the book was being sold. I was doing radio show with Stan Friedman, and we had a lot of publicity on this, and I had no idea that the book was butchered the way it was, because as I gave the okay, the final version as I knew it did not come out like that, Alejandro, not whatsoever. The book was basically butchered, and people were actually coming up to me while I was on book tour in West Virginia and different locations. They would come to see me at a regular spot I was working at, or they would follow me on my tour. And they said, well, we heard you on the radio, Frank, talking with Stan about this, that, and the other. How come you didn't put that in a book? I'm like, of course I did. That's one of the most important key parts of the book. And they say, well, you show me. And basically I was turning to that chapter and page, and I was going, oh, my God, it's gone. And the whole book was basically like that. It was poorly edited and chopped up, and I had no idea. So basically, I walked away from it, and I withdrew, and I have not endorsed the book. And it took me several years to get my rights back, to break away from the publisher.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank goodness.
Several years with different attorneys, and finally I got a law firm in West Virginia who represented me, and we had a settlement agreement, and I got the rights to my book back.
Yeah,
because it was not just edited poorly. It contained over 150 documented mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
When the book was retyped and then edited and put back together, it was just done very sloppy. So it was very disappointing to me, my colleagues, my family, everybody who had worked for so many years on this. So by the time I got the rights back, I had to put this whole book back together, had to straighten that out, and in the meantime, my investigation did not stop, and I kept finding new information.
Mm-hmm.
So right now I'm doing a self-published book. I'm the only person who has laid a finger on it because I was scared to go out and have another publisher edit it and work on it after what I went through, and it cost a small fortune.
Right.
And, attorney fees to boot, so basically, that's what happened. So now I have this unbelievable book with information. I actually did all the illustrations in it.
Oh, really?
I did my own maps. I did all my own graphics. I'm an illustrator. I went to Perry College of Art in New Haven. And I graduated in illustration and advertising as a minor, so I have a very strong background in painting. And that was a really big part of this whole story, Alejandro, because what happened is the Flatwoods Monster illustration that was drawn back in 1952 was incorrect. And that's the picture that's been seen in a million different magazines and, you know, it was seen on national television back then in newspapers. And when I sat down with the witnesses, they told me it didn't look like that. So being an illustrator, I sat down with these people for on and off for several years. And I would basically do police-style renderings, sitting with the witnesses. And they would give me descriptions, and I would draw sketches. And I'm like, well, here, you draw it. Let me, you know, you give me a little input. And we'd both be sitting there, and, you know, of course they can't illustrate like I can. So they did these drawings, and then I would pick the pencil back. And we did this on and off for quite a while. We did thumbnail sketches. Then I did comprehensive sketches. I would give the illustrations back to the people. Sometimes I was back going back and forth between Florida and West Virginia. Sometimes I would actually mail the drawings. I would come home and work on them and talk to them on the phone. And finally we got it to the point where the witnesses I worked with said, Frank, this is about as close as we remember this, and it's about as close as what this so-called Flatwoods Monster actually looked like. And it wasn't a monster at all. It was a small mechanical probe-like device that hovered. The original illustration was done by a sketch artist on the We the People show on September 19, 1952, and he sat down with Kathleen May and Gene Lemon, who were the two primary witnesses, adult witnesses. And when they interviewed him, this guy did this quick sketch. A little bit while later, this was before the show, and a little bit while later, they played the spooky music. There was an orchestra playing all this music. The MC, Daniel Seymour, came out. He gave his little spiel introduction, and they flashed this picture up on the screen. And from that day forward, everybody thought that's what this thing looked like. It was basically a hooded monster with arms and claws wearing a dress.
Right.
And it hovered. And from that point forward, the whole story got kind of looked at cockeyed. It was kind of ridiculous. But the one thing it did have going for is the witnesses never wavered from their original statements. It was not the fault of the witnesses. The story got botched up. It had to do with the original drawing.
Which is what always happens, especially with media. I mean, they want something quick, so they can get it out, and accuracy often takes a backseat
to it. Yeah, exactly. And that's what happened in this case.
Well, let's get into the details of the case, because I don't think a lot of people these days know too much about this case. I think if they see the drawing once in a while, they'll recognize it. But this was a pretty important case, a lot of witnesses. And let's start with the beginning on this case.
Well, basically what happened is this story was one of the top news stories in 1952. A lot of stuff going on in 52, and it was unbelievable at this story. I have read in my research that ABC News rated it as the 10th biggest news story of that year.
Wow.
And for a UFO story, that was quite a thing back then, and when the story broke, it shotgun pretty quick. And a little background, probably most of your listeners know that 52 was the banner year for UFO sightings. It's, you know, called basically the nickname the year of the saucer. And 52 had a record amount of UFO reports that were sent to Blue Book, who was in charge of UFO sightings and reporting. And there was 1,501 reports, and during that year alone, there was 303 unknowns, which was quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And during the whole summer flap of 1952, we had a very high amount of reports, and that just for a short 4-month time. June had 148. We jumped to July with the famous Washington, D.C. sightings on back-to-back weekends. There was 536, 326, and it started slowing down towards the end of the summer. In September, there was 124. So we have 1,134 reports during the summer of 52, and it's quite amazing. There was a lot of unknowns, 111, according to Blue Book. And that's quite a lot just for 4 months,
yeah,
when you look at the 22-year span of Blue Book, you know, when they were in existence. So there was a lot of stuff going on in 1952. As it started slowing down a little bit, Alejandro, what happened is this story of the Flatwoods Monster or Braxton County Monster blasted out into the media within 2 days that it happened. And it was looked at kind of strange at the beginning because of what this little silly monster looked like,
mm-hmm,
which is basically, if there's pictures on my website, which is flatwoodsmonster.com. There's pictures on there and all over the internet. And, well, like I said earlier, when the witnesses went on, they gave their descriptions of what they said this thing looked like, and the guy botched up the drawing, and he drew this ridiculous-looking thing. Well, shortly after this case happened, I started looking into what happened the previous night. Okay, the story didn't break until a couple days later. Well, when I started researching the story, I looked at what was going on the very night that happened. And the following night, the night of the incident and the following day is when the reportage started of four states bombarded by meteor-like object headlines, balls of fire in Pittsburgh, fireball shower city area, authorities probe flashes in area, UFO sightings and flaming objects passing around the United States, crashing plane believed meteor, Scorsese green light over area. I'm just giving you a few examples. So this is when I started looking into this a little deeper, and I said there's a lot more that was going on in this little Flatwoods Monster case. Basically, everybody just looked at what happened in that one little community. There was 300 people that lived in Flatwoods. Flatwoods is the geographical center of West Virginia. What I started doing is plotting different locations around the United States. One of the key points of the story is an article that was actually carried on September 13th, the day after the Flatwoods incident. The Flatwoods incident didn't start picking up the story of the monster itself until Sunday the 14th and the 15th and 16th. Those were the power days. But it was the day after where all of these different mysterious objects were seen flying around the United States. And the key one that caught my attention was called the Flame Over Washington. And this is Washington, D.C., and it was a United Press article, dateline September 12th. And a flaming object passed west over Washington, D.C., and was seen by hundreds and thousands along its flight path as it flew west, passing over the Capitol. It flew into Virginia, and it ultimately flew into West Virginia. So what I started doing is getting all the articles together, and I started pinpointing all the locations where all of these sightings occurred. And eventually, I had to start getting maps from all over the United States, up and down the East Coast. And Project Blue Book actually had a lot of this information in their files. And I was kind of shocked when I first got the Project Blue Book microfilm. I almost hit the ground when I found out that the whole microfilm was for September 12th and 13th. Some of these reels will go on for weeks and a month, you know, with on one spool. The September 12th and 13th took up one whole microfilm reel. That's how many sightings occurred. So it was very interesting. Well, when I started looking into the different locations, I found out that there were sightings over Delaware, Maryland, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, down into Tennessee. There were sightings up in Virginia, D.C., and West Virginia. This was reported around the United States. Now, I'm going to bring up the point, this took years to figure out. Years to figure and try to get all of this information in some kind of an order. When I got the Project Blue Book microfilm, I went through it, and the sightings, most of them corresponded, except Project Blue Book did not list Delaware, Ohio, or Tennessee, which were key points of this whole story, which is kind of weird, having all these reports, except, you know, how can all of this stuff have went on over these three states, and that wasn't even in Blue Book. That stuff was in all the newspapers. And the newspapers did not piece together what had happened that night. The media is not, we kind of take for granted what we have today with the internet. We can find something now in a heartbeat by jumping online and Googling something, or, you know, cell phones, communications. Back then, it was nothing like that. So there was stuff going up and down the East Coast of the United States that night that nobody ever pinpointed and put together. Well, what I found out is that tons of civilian and military witnesses had seen UFOs over all of those states. Then I looked a little bit further, and I found out that there were sightings in California and Illinois, too. So you have actually 11 different states where there were saucers, different shaped crafts, cigar-shaped objects. There was tons of them seen. So what I did is I got maps for each one of these states, and I started pinpointing them and putting them together. Then I had to get bigger maps, and eventually I made a gigantic master map of the eastern United States, from Canada all the way down to Florida. And I started pinpointing all of these areas. And there was people that had been civilian and military witnesses had reported these sightings to the Pentagon, Air Force bases up and down the coast. The state police headquarters, local police were involved, airports, all these government agencies, the Civil Aeronautics Administration, the FBI, and the Navy. Everybody was contacted, and I was standing back and going, this is unbelievable. Nobody even knows what happened that night. And all these different agencies were contacted by frantic people who had seen these things flying all over the place. Well, some of them were flying at treetop level and crashing throughout the United States. So what I did, Alejandro, is I eventually got this big map and pieced it together. It's an aeronautical map. I live near Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University, so there's a wealth of information with their gigantic library. So I spent years going back and forth to Embry-Riddle and researching. I put together this big gigantic map, and you could see it on the homepage of flatwoodsmonster.com, and click on it, and there's actually different shots and pictures of it. I was able to figure out that there was 102 locations where witnesses had seen and reported these UFOs that had passed over their area. So on the map, you can look and you could see all the dots and all these different areas where these UFOs were seen. And a chunk of them, probably the majority of them, were reported in Blue Book. They were right there. Nobody had ever taken the time to break everything down and segregate it and put it into an order. Now, like I said, this took years to figure out what was going on. So I have all of these plotted points. Stan Friedman got some colleagues and together, and they looked a little bit further into it, and they sent me more information. So in the end, we have 102 locations where these UFOs were seen that night. Over 21 hours of sustained hours. The chunk of them occurred in about an hour and a half. The majority of these sightings, it was like a blitzkrieg, like the floodgates opened up and there were UFOs seen all over the United States, and the public went batty that night. So
about
what time was that?
What was that hour?
Okay, approximately let me say first that Washington, D.C. and West Virginia were in different time zones. Basically, when all of this started was just before 8 p.m. Eastern Daylight Savings Time, and West Virginia was 7 p.m.
Okay.
Okay, and that was very confusing at the beginning because we have different time zones, and then we have different EDT, ESTs. And when they were reported by the United Press, the time zones were all different. So it was a nightmare to figure this stuff out. What I actually did is when I went to Embry-Riddle, I found the commercial flight books for the airliners. And I was able to figure out what time zones and who observed what areas, because West Virginia was actually in two different time zones. They were in standard and Eastern Day. Yeah, standard and Eastern Daylight Savings Time. The northern part of the state, the northern panhandle, was in a different time zone from the other part of the state. And when I was trying to figure out the flight pass, it got pretty crazy there. So in the end, I have all of these plotted locations. I have times. I even know some of the heights where these UFOs flew on their trajectories. And I work with different people, and one particular fella I worked with, he helped me to put this all into some type of a sense. I have this big, gigantic map, and this fella, he was a military expert and historian, he looked at my map, and he said, "Frank, do you know what the hell you have here?" And I said, "Not really. I'm going crazy trying to figure out what actually happened. We have all of this stuff all over here," and I had some times. And he stood there and looked at this map on the wall. He picked up one of my drafting rulers, and he started connecting points all over the United States. I had a rough idea of what was going on, but this guy looked at it, and he knew it in a heartbeat. Military people love reading this, looking at the map. Because what happened is, in the end, we figured out there was three damaged UFOs which had flown over the eastern seaboard and split into a pattern and flew towards different strategic military installations and targets. And the first UFO actually flew and passed all the way down, heading on a trajectory towards Oak Ridge, Tennessee, which is heading in a southwest direction. And we have all the pinpoints of this thing going. It flew 100 miles through the Oak Ridge no-fly zone. It was a UFO. The second UFO had come in shortly after, and it headed in the opposite direction. It went northwest, and it flew over Baltimore, went across the United States. And if the listeners want to view this, you can look at it on a map, and there's pinpoints all the way going across the United States. It was flying up towards Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. It was unbelievable seeing this thing laid out. And what that UFO did is it flew right just short of Wright Pat. The third UFO came and threaded the needle, as I call it, and came right down the middle. That was the flame over Washington. That passed over Washington, D.C., the most damaged object, and it continued west. Now, what is the amazing part, and this took me years to figure out, I pulled together all the information from Project Blue Book, and being an illustrator, I sat down and I drew thumbnail sketches, worked my way into comprehensive drawings, and then did paintings. Because when that of different UFOs, because what happened, Alejandro, was when that third UFO came down and flew over Washington, quote, the flame over Washington, according to the New York Times, when that object flew over the Capitol area, there was 12 UFOs that descended from the sky and formed an aerial perimeter around it and followed it west and protected it. There was hundreds of people standing in Washington, D.C., Virginia, and the Maryland area watching these UFOs drop out of the sky. Their jaws hit the ground. And this is all documented in a Project Blue Book, except nobody ever pieced together what was going on. There were several different objects. And what I did is I took, I used the tentative observers questionnaires. And what that was if somebody saw a UFO, they would write to the Air Force, they would send them this questionnaire, and they would fill it out. What direction was it going? Draw an illustration. What did it look like? What shape was it? What size? How far were you from it? So I took all of these tons of questionnaire forms, and I broke all the information down, and I was able to figure out how many different UFOs that were seen over that area. And between 8 o'clock and 8:10, 12 of them dropped out of the sky, and they followed this damaged one west. It was amazing. And when it got outside of Washington over the Virginia area, these UFOs ascended back up into the sky. I kept tracking this thing across the United States, and if you look at the map close and zoom in on it, it was seen over Front Royal, Virginia. It flew into Virginia. It flew as far as the area of Burnsville, which is in central West Virginia. Now, this whole time here took approximately 25 minutes. Stanton Friedman and myself, we figured this out from the point where it was seen here over the different areas. When it flew into West Virginia, it was just under 25 minutes it took. Then it redirected and turned south, and it passed over small communities at low levels and actually followed the main artery going into Braxton County, into Flatwoods. It flew over the road, treetop level, some places where it was actually seen, and it continued and flew all the way down into Flatwoods.
So, and now, really, just so the listeners know, I mean, up until now, this is where the traditional, what is known as the Flatwoods Monster story begins, but everything prior that we just talked about, all of these sightings and these witnesses, this was your research. I mean,
this is
your new research that you discovered everything prior to what we're talking about.
Ivan Sanderson, one of the first researchers into this story, he knew that there were sightings over the Baltimore area, and he knew there were some sightings around the D.C. area. But when these guys were doing their research years ago, Project Blue Book wasn't available.
Mm-hmm.
It was not declassified at that point. And Gray Barker, another early investigator from West Virginia, he made the story very popular. He concentrated on the hub of the sightings that happened, and through his research, right in the area, right in Braxton County. So he knew something crazy was going on with all these sightings over that area of West Virginia. Sanderson knew there were some of them that had occurred over the D.C. area, but nobody was able to piece it together. And it's just, you know, investigative work and plotting points and connecting the dots.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were so well referenced in Project Blue Book and in the media, it's you connect your dots and you figure out the times and you just follow the trail.
Mm-hmm.
The Flatwoods craft actually was damaged. The three of them were damaged. But the one thing that I'm going to jump back for 2 seconds, when that flame over Washington, which was the Flatwoods craft, when that flew over Washington, do you remember the other two I just told you about? The one that was going towards Oak Ridge and the one that was gunning up towards Wright Pat?
Mm-hmm.
When that thing passed safely over the Capitol area and the other UFOs had ascended from the sky, they formed an actual perimeter around it to protect it. When it was not intercepted over that immediate area, and we timed it out, the other two turned away because it was not a threat to it. There was no attempt made to take this thing down over the Washington area because it actually flew dead right over D.C.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically, that was a real ballsy maneuver. You know, okay, you want to come after us? You want to take this damaged ship down? They were guarding it, first of all. And then when it passed safely over, the other one descended. The other two turned away. And when you look at the map, you'll see how close this thing actually got towards Oak Ridge. It flew 100 miles through the no-fly zone. Tried doing that today.
Mm-hmm.
What happens, and there was no interceptions made against it. And there's three primary Air Force bases that form a triad around Wright Pat. There was nothing scrambled at it. And the other one that flew up towards Wright Patterson turned, redirected away, and flew towards Wheeling, Ohio County Airport. And the Wheeling area papers and the Eastern Ohio newspapers covered this extensively.
Hmm.
There was unbelievable amounts of sightings. And it nearly collided with a passenger plane near the airport, Wheeling, Ohio County Airport. And then it redirected and it went south and came back into West Virginia. So these things were going all over the place, flying in different directions. And it was cool to be able to figure out what was going on. It was basically a military strategy. I've been on and off book tours for years, and when the people see my master map of what I actually put together, the military guys really love it. And they just look at it and they go, wow, this is unbelievable, Frank.
So, and three of them then were damaged. Two flew away, the one going towards Ohio and then one towards Tennessee. But the
one directed back out.
Braxton County, I would assume you're getting that. Didn't get away, a crash?
That is the one that landed. Well, what happened is it came in, there were pieces falling off of it, it was in flames, and it was flying at a low altitude.
Hmm.
It actually burned the treetops coming in over one part of the town. I spoke to a witness and says, it was a woman, and she says it actually hit the tops of the trees. And when I was up in Flatwoods 2-3 years ago for a public appearance, this witness took me up to a part and said, see that tree line over there? It used to be sure that whole area was burnt along the top and the foliage was brown. So, you know, it was really great to work with the witnesses. A majority of them had passed away over the years. Mrs. May died a couple of years ago. I interviewed Colonel Dale Levitt. He was the head of the West Virginia National Guard. He fought in World War II. Just a lot of witnesses that I worked with and videotaped. Thank God I videotaped them because I have all of this stuff and I was able to put it into the book, and I just kept researching. And what I found out is once I went public over years ago, people email me, they call me, I've met witnesses. Whenever I go to West Virginia, they, you know, it's a close-knit community up there. And the way the people were ridiculed from the onset about this whole thing, they knew I was not out to make fools out of them because I had the evidence. I had the Blue Book documents.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually used the government documents and figured it out. I don't know how much the government had figured out, but I spent close to 15 years 14, 15 years just trying to figure this story out up to that point, and I've just continued with it and shotgunned out.
Wow.
And this is what the new book is. And every time I go to West Virginia, people tell me more information. They're scared to talk about it. They think people are going to laugh at it. So that was really great to be able to, you know, form this relationship with the locals up there because they knew I wasn't out to make a joke out of it.
So were there any witnesses that saw, because I know there were witnesses and previously at least they had described a red light coming in over the treetops and seeing the object prior to people on the ground, you know, seeing something on the ground. Did anybody see the object crash or the craft on the ground?
The Flatwoods craft you're talking about.
Yes.
Well, what happened, Alejandro, is when it flew on a western flight path, okay, when it hit the Burnsville area, it flew south.
Mm-hmm.
It followed the road, the contour of the road, and when I showed my maps to Stan Friedman years ago, we started putting this thing together, he was amazed because what the things did, this UFO, and there were others that were seen up in that area that night, they were following the roads and cutting between the mountains and the ridges. And Stanton said, that's amazing. He said, that's what we did in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
He says, our pilots, you know, if you get lost, you follow the rivers, you follow the roads, you stay away from the mountains, you don't want to crash, and you just follow the contour and the cuts. And that's what this thing did, is it followed the road and flew over the road all the way into Flatwoods. And I have pinpointed areas. I have witnesses I've interviewed who saw it coming down from that area. One of them was actually over Burnsville, and the thing was just skimming the treetops. This thing was gigantic. It was over 30 foot long and approximately 16 to 18 foot tall, and it looked like a big, gigantic egg, kind of like a football shape.
Hmm.
It was aerodynamic. This thing flew over Flatwoods, and it actually went off course a bit, and it flew over a mountaintop, a mountain range area. And as it headed towards the area of Flatwoods, there was a bunch of kids playing football that night. And they would pick up sandlot football. And this UFO actually came over the school playground area, and it turned and redirected. And it headed back east, and it went up on top of the Bailey Fisher Farm, which is a high point in that area. It cleared the treetops, and it actually didn't come in and crash per se, like you would think of an airplane crash coming straight into the ground. It kind of decelerated and then hovered over an area, which is a cleared field, and it kind of just like dropped straight down to the ground. And all of these kids saw this thing. I actually have another adult witness who was on the other side of town who saw this thing coming in. And he told me it wasn't a meteor, Frank. This thing wasn't a meteor. It was being flown. It was controlled. And it was amazing because the locals up there were telling me that this thing looked like it was being controlled. And when I read some of the Blue Book documents of the craft after it flew over that Washington area, the witnesses were saying the same thing. This thing wasn't a meteor. This thing was being flown. It was being controlled. And, you know, it was coming in at this low level. And by the way, back then the radar was only capable of picking up from 5,000 feet up. So in a lot of cases when these things would drop low, they were actually flying under radar. So it was kind of hard to get a fix on them. So they were flying very low. So anyways, back into Flatwoods, when this thing touched down, a bunch of the kids dropped everything and they ran off. Now, you know, you have half of the town of kids were playing pickup football. They ran up the road up towards Depot Street. They ran across the railroad tracks, and they went up to the house of Kathleen May. Two of the boys in the group, Eddie and Freddie, this was their mom. Okay, they ran into the front door. There's a whole pile of kids coming in there, and they're screaming and yelling, you know, something landed up on the hill. Mrs. May was with her cousin, Gene Lemon, an adult who's 18 years old. He was actually a West Virginia National Guard reserve. He was there visiting, and here come all these kids barrel-assing into the door screaming. Something landed up on the top hill. Mrs. May's home and property is right borders that area of the Fisher Farm. So Mrs. May and Gene Lemon grabbed their flashlights. It was starting to get dusk. The sun was setting, and they're going to start trekking up into the back farm there of the Fisher Farm to see what landed. And in the meantime, a bunch of the kids got scared. They didn't want to go up, so a whole bunch of them left and went home. So basically, in the end, we have Kathleen May. We have a group of boys. We had Gene Lemon, 18. We have Neil Nunley, he was 14. Teddy Neal, 13. Eddie May, 13. Freddie May, who I worked extensively with. Ron Shaver, another fella that I had met and talked with. He was 10 years old. And then we have a little boy called Tommy Heyer. He wasn't playing ball that night. He was actually up there in the area, and when all the commotion went on and all the kids were running onto the farm, he joined them. Okay, so in the end, we have 8 witnesses that were known. I had been told by several of the locals up there through my research, there was up to 14 kids who went up there. The primary ones went up to the farm right up to where the encounter happened, but I was told there was a lot of kids who kind of hung back way, way back at the entrance to the farm and didn't actually go up there, okay? So I work with some of these witnesses, and what happened is they started out and walking up to the farm, the main portion of the farm where it starts. There's a big, wide-open pasture. And I'm going to give you the layout of the land because this is important, Alejandro, which I call the first field. It's a big, flat, wide-open field. It's a pasture. Then that is divided by a big, gigantic fence line, and over to the left-hand portion of the property, there's a big steel gate. Okay, the farm basically looks the same now, but it's been, the property was bought and the place was all cleaned up and it looks like a dude ranch. It looks nothing now like the way it did in 52, but the fence line is basically there. And we have over to the left the main portion where they kept the animals on the main part of the farm. Okay, that's where the fence was. Out into what I call the second field, there is a gully. And it's a big pasture, and it drops off pretty severely, and it slopes down to the right. The far back third field is actually the third field that's elevated on a high plateau, and that is where the craft originally touched down. And when I was starting to research this, I met a fellow called Jack Davis, who was very helpful. He is the fellow who actually saw the craft come in and disappear behind the tree lines. Jack was very helpful. He drove me around for several trips over the years to different parts of Flatwoods, because he grew up there. He knew every inch of that property and surrounding area. He drove me all over the outline perimeter of the farm, and I saw the farm from elevated areas and mountains overlooking from afar. And what I was amazed at, Jack took me to one point that was miles away, and we went up this long, windy road. We went up this mountain, parked the car, and we walked into a field, and we're miles away. He says, "Frank, look out across the mountains over there." And all you saw was green, Alejandro, trees, greens. There was one open area, which looked like a bald spot on a man's head, that sat out in the middle. That's where the thing landed.
Wow.
He said, "Frank, that's why that thing landed there." And I took my binoculars out, and I looked, and there it was. I didn't even know where I was. I'm driving through the mountains. Without the help of the locals there, I wouldn't have, I would have no idea. But anyways, what I'm trying to get the point is this thing made a controlled landing and landed on a plateau of a wide open field surrounded by trees on 3 different sides. So when that craft had touched down, what it actually did is, in the meanwhile, while Mrs. May and Lemon and all the boys are walking up there, this thing had actually relocated and flown into the second field or the gully, and it dropped down to a lower point. When Stanton Friedman was up there, Stanton's been up there a couple times. The first time he was up there, we walked around, and he was amazed, and he said, "Frank, it all makes sense now. It touched down up there, and then it relocated into the gully because this thing was glowing, and you could see this thing for miles away. It dropped into the lower point and tucked itself away over on the side, and there was a bunch of pear trees that were surrounding it. When Mrs. May and the boys were, by the time they got from the house, they walked up the little dirt road and they hit the first field. That thing had relocated already, and it was sitting tucked away in the corner of the gully or the sloped pasture. And as Mrs. May was walking up there with Lemon, she was focused ahead. The kids were looking way to the back, and they're all pointing. They're saying, it landed up there. This thing actually had moved, and it wasn't up there anymore. It was over there. And as Mrs. May was coming up across the horizon, she saw big purplish flares that lit up the farm. And that was quite interesting. She saw the skylight up over the farm when this thing was pulsing and glowing back and forth. And it was kind of tough to see because there were trees and shrubs and there were stuff. The farm was pretty wild looking back then, mm-hmm. not like it looks today. So what happened is they got up to the entrance onto the main part of the farm. Now, that's where they used to put the animals to graze, the horses and the cows and everything. They would get stuck out there, and that was basically their pen. When the group got up to this metal gate, they were basically strung out like a wagon train. And Mrs. May and Lemon were leading the way. They got to this metal gate. They all passed through it. Okay. Now they rewired the gate, as they would do, because, you know, there's animals running around.
Right.
And they didn't know, you know, if the animals were put out that day or whatever. So, you know, they're good town folk. Always rewire your neighbor's fence. Because a backup, then, you know, they wouldn't shoot you if you walked onto somebody's property.
Yeah.
And when they passed over this gate into this gated area, Alejandro, they hit this path. And it was basically a gravel path, gravel and dirt. The pasture is over to their right. Over to the left is the woods. And this path actually follows up to the tree line. Okay, as they started walking up the tree line along this path, which is a few feet wide, Mrs. May and some of the witnesses started hearing these weird noises coming up from ahead. Over to the left, Mrs. May had heard something that sounded like a thumping noise. She described it as like a stretched piece of canvas or a drum, like a bass drum being hit. She called it a silver dollar, like this thud. Freddie May told me way off into the right of the pasture, he heard this, what he called a whining noise. And he didn't know how to describe it, and this was never picked up or reported in the press back then. But he told me in an interview on the spot, and basically he's the one that walked through this whole thing step by step with me and recreated it. He said he heard this whining noise out in the distance on the farm. And he said he didn't know what it was. He had no idea. And it wasn't until he became an adult and worked at Union Carbide, he said the first day that they shut their big generators down, it was that whining noise, whining down. He said, that is the same noise that I heard coming that night. And this was several years later. He was just a kid when he saw this. And he said, the hair stood up on his neck. And he had a flashback. He said, that's the same damn noise that I heard on the farm that night, which sounded like the generator whining down real. It was fast, and then, you know, it would get slower, and it was like this squealing noise. He heard that as they start walking up this path. They're headed looking up to the third area where they saw this thing land. They weren't really focusing, looking down here. A couple of the kids saw the pulses and the flashes. They're looking straight ahead up there. As they started getting into this area where there's a second gate, this whole area of the path became filled with this sulfur-smelling smoke. And Mrs. May told me it wasn't your usual fog. This stuff was gagging them, and they were choking. Some of them, their eyes were tearing from it, and it was this really bad stench. Mrs. May said she also heard something that sounded like frying bacon in a pan. It was sizzling. Something was really hot. They got up to this area, and there's a second gate, and it didn't open up. It was actually two big, gigantic posts, kind of like telephone poles, and they had nailed slats from post to post. At that point, Mrs. May had got up to this gated area with Lemon, Neil Nunley, Eddie May, who was her older son, and Ronnie Shaver. There was a dog that had followed them up. I probably should have mentioned this earlier, but there was a dog from the neighborhood, which was a collie. And this is an important part because it followed them up, and it actually went over as it went through the gate slats. They crawled over it, and this collie was following them, and Freddie May also had a dog that was with him. It was a smaller little dog. The big dog, when it got up to the gate, and this is where the fog was starting to get quite a bit heavier, this wooden gate, it darted off into the fog, and it was tearing ass up this hill. Now, this whole time, it's an incline because they're walking up to the back mountaintop plateau. This dog runs into this fog, and it's a sulfur smell, and it gets up a few feet ahead, which would probably be it's about 60 to 70 feet. It disappears around the bend, and Mrs. May said she heard a yelp. The dog just yelped. A second later, it comes running back down the hill, goes through the gate, and it runs back to the house. Mrs. May and the other group, they cross the gate, and they're walking up to this area. And it's a low fog. She said it was like low and rumbling, like it was being emitted from something. And it's just rolling into the area. The kids some of the younger kids are starting to cough because, you know, they're not that tall. They're starting to cough, and they keep pushing through. They're looking to go way out to the back. That's where they're focused, and they're damned and determined. We're going to go see what landed up there, not realizing the thing had went way the hell over there on the other side of the farm. They're walking up. There's what Mrs. May called a swag, and it was the area where, now you're still going uphill. You're going up, 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 and it starts turning to the left. They're walking up this area, Mrs. May and Lemon, and they're kind of going back and forth. And they don't have their flashlights on at this point because they didn't know how long they were going to be up on the site. And there was still enough of light where they could just see. It was starting to get dark. And Freddie May had told me this in one of the interviews. He said, you always tried to save your batteries because you didn't want to be out in those woods and having it on needlessly and then have to get home and walk through the woods in dark up there with all of the animals and stuff. It's pretty scary. So they didn't have their flashlights on at this point. They're moving along. Now the noise is starting to intensify. Mrs. May said this noise started getting louder and louder. We have the whining noise over in the field. Mrs. May said she hears this stuff that sounds like frying bacon, and it's getting louder. They're walking along the tree line about 3.5 to 4 feet set back off of the trail. There is this white oak tree that's over 100 feet tall, and this is the area where the noises are coming from. This is also the area where this smoke is generating from, and it's pouring out from behind this tree. Mrs. May and Lemon are walking towards the tree, and the rest of the boys are following her. They're all scattered around there, and at this point, you have Freddie May, Teddy Neal, and little Tommy Heyer had just got to the gate. Okay, they're looking up at the rest of the group's backs, and when I work with Kathleen and work with Freddie and did my illustrations and interviews, it was really cool because when the encounter occurred, Freddie May saw it happen unfold in front of him. He had the faraway perspective of it. Mrs. May was right in on top of it and saw up close and personal. She started walking towards this tree, and her and Gene Lemon saw something up about 12 feet in the air, and they were big eyes. They thought, actually, at first, that they were the eyes of an animal, a possum. They didn't know what they were. They were set way up and up towards this branch, which was about 12 feet in the air. And they saw these big eyes situated right near this limb. Well, they got closer to it, and Lemon and Mrs. May flashed their flashlight on it up towards these eyes, and they're thinking it's an animal. A possum or a raccoon or something was up there. Well, what it was, this gigantic thing that looked like basically like a robot. It was made out of like this metallic type material, and you'll see my illustrations online. It hovered from behind this tree down this 3.5 to 4 foot slope, and it hovered across the ground right in front of Mrs. May and Lemon. Lemon got real shaken up. Mrs. May said his legs just got rubbery. This thing came right towards him. It was 12 feet tall. It was a big craft. This is what what people said was the Flatwoods Monster.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a monster. It was a vehicle, Alejandro. It hovered in front of Mrs. May. She said she was as close to it as a small car, just a few feet. This thing came right almost on top of them, hovered across Mrs. May. Mrs. May is to the inside of the path along the tree line. Lemon is to just to her right. Lemon fell over, and the kids screamed. Mrs. May had yelled, and this thing came right in front of her, a few feet away, and it had splattered. This thing was somehow damaged. It was splattered this oil. It was like leaking this oil, and it splattered, and it hit the whole front of Mrs. May. She had her uniform on from work. She was a beautician. She hadn't even taken it off that night. She went straight up there with the kids, and this oil splattered and hit the front of her, right, her upper torso, right down to her, past her waist, was covered with oil, and it was like a dark substance. Lemon picked himself up. Mrs. May turned. And Freddie May is back at the gate with the other two kids. One was Tommy Heyer. He saw this whole thing unfold in front of him. And that's why it was so great, like I said a minute ago, is when I was working and putting all of this together and figuring out the timeline and the sequence and who was standing where, it's basically reenacting a case, an incident, and putting this
right.
case together. And when I did my illustrations, I was able to figure out who was standing here, where, and who. And when I wrote the book, I was able to put this all into a strict chronological order. And Freddie May saw it unfold from afar. Mrs. May told me from the point-blank view, she saw what this monster looked like up close. Freddie got a good overview of the whole thing from a distance. It was so close to Mrs. May, you know, she couldn't see some of the details because it was so close to her.
Right.
You know what I mean? It was like almost on top of her.
So in your picture, the eyes look like there's a light coming out of them.
Right. And I'll explain what that is, because a lot of people make fun of that, and they say, oh, it's a monster shooting beams of light out like rays, you know, like from a science fiction movie. Kathleen and Freddie told me what had happened is this thing was basically in a dormant state, and it was actually right at ground level when it was behind the tree. What it did, Alejandro, is when it landed out on into the portion, its second landing in the slope, it actually hovered through the tall grass and weeds. It left the trail. This thing was about 4 foot wide at the base. It was gigantic.
Mm-hmm.
It can't, and it was basically, it hovered. If you look at the original drawings, the good thing the drawing shows is the drop cast shadow, which shows that this thing was elevated above the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And that's why people were saying, what the hell is this monster wearing a Sweet 16 dress, wearing a hood with arms and claws? It floats. Well, it floated because it had a propulsion system. What Mrs. May was trying to describe, the pleats and her drapes in her living room look like the lower torso of this so-called monster. They were actually pipes. What she was trying to describe were the pleats and the slats coming down. And they were pipes that went around the lower circumference. Freddie May, in an interview when we were doing a drawing, he held his arm out in front of him. And he said, Frank, that's about how big those pipes were going around that lower torso.
Wow.
He said they were the size of like a fireman's hose. And he held his arm up front. He said that's how big it was. The pipes were, and they went around the whole lower area. The smell that was noted in the area and that foggy stuff that was rolling down the hill was actually the exhaust. That's what made this thing float. When it came across Mrs. May, she said, Frank, it floated. She called it floated, hovered about a foot to a foot and a half off the ground. And that's where the exhaust was. That was where the sulfur smell was.
Mm-hmm.
So as it came, it actually came up, went across the path up behind the tree. After the sighting of the encounter, it moved in front of Mrs. May. It went by Gene Lemon. And then it went back down towards the slope. They all saw this unfold. Freddie May and the two kids at the gate, they bolted first.
Mm-hmm.
Mrs. May and the rest of the boys, they bolted down, and they had to go over that fence. Mrs. May told me she leaped it like a hurdler in the Olympics. She went straight over and never touched it.
Wow.
And they all went back down to the house, and what had happened subsequently is later that night when Ailey Stewart, who was the Johnny on the Spot reporter who went up there, and he eventually broke the story to the world. I interviewed him extensively. I stayed up at his house for about 4 days, and I lived there with him, and I did an interview with him. And he gave me a good layout of what was going on. Actually, what the locals had called skid marks, and this is documented by the earlier researchers, were actually the path marks made of this smaller craft leaving the bigger craft that went across the field, went up there, and it actually followed a parallel path and went back across and up to its craft again, and then it left. So Ailey Stewart told me basically it was like having a big gigantic leaf blower that was 4 foot wide,
mm-hmm.
and just carving a path through the pasture.
Right.
And the parallel path went back down to the craft, and this was well documented. This mm-hmm. and Stewart told me when he was actually the first one back out there the following morning when the sun came up. And he's the one who actually saw it for the first time in daylight. And he was walking through the path, he told me, and he said there were small stones that were overturned and flipped over from the force of this thing.
But the craft was gone by that time. Well, everything was gone by that time. Well,
yeah, what had happened is by the time Mrs. May and the kids got back down to the house, they were all hysterical. They called up the local sheriff's department, and the sheriff was not there, nor the deputy. The state troopers were out of the area. There were calls in the meantime, Alejandro, of UFOs crashing and puddle jumping across Braxton County. And there were other UFOs seen all through the area. And there were actually sightings prior to the craft landing. And then there were sightings after the craft landed. And Gray Barker, one of the original investigators, documented a lot of this, and he just pulled his hair out. He had no flipping idea what was going on, because there were crafts that came over the area that were gigantic and cigar shaped. Then you had the Flatwoods craft. Then there were some UFOs that were like round balls. And all of these UFOs were seen during the early 50s to 52 and on. It wasn't like they, you know, these descriptions of these craft were, you know, really absurd. They had been well documented for years.
Mm-hmm.
And all of these UFOs were seen over this area of Braxton County. Well, when Mrs. May called up the sheriff's department, he was out running around chasing a UFO that had crashed. It wasn't the Flatwoods craft. It was another one. There was another craft that was damaged that came from the direction of Florida over the Carolinas, came in the backside of Virginia, and I tracked it going into Braxton County. And to make a long story short, this was the fourth damaged craft in the picture that night. It was actually the first one. And what had happened is I was trying to figure out why there were two of them. One came from the south, one came from the east and flew west. And I sat down with an old military guy and I showed him all my research. I laid it out on the table. And he basically said to me, "Frank, do you understand what happened here that night?" I'm like, "Will you please help me? I'm starting to pull my hair out." He said there was two severely damaged crafts, and they tried putting them into the same area. Flatwoods was the designated rendezvous area for two major damaged crafts. The one that came in first over Flatwoods, it was supposed to rendezvous with the main craft. The Flatwoods craft hadn't come all the way in from D.C. There were two UFOs, damaged UFOs, severely damaged UFOs that were supposed to rendezvous in that area. The Flatwoods one came in too late. The other one took off and it actually flew over the farm. And there were other UFOs looking for it. It was a search and rescue mission. All this stuff is documented. It just had to be put together. And by me working with different military people, because I don't have a military background, I've learned a hell of a lot over 20 years. What they did is they tried to put these two UFOs into the same area to rendezvous. What happened is one that came in from the south, and I have it documented. You see it on the master map. It was documented in Blue Book, all the papers. When it came in, the other ship hadn't come in yet. It was still coming, flying on a western trajectory. And we were able to figure this out by the times. We knew where each craft was at a certain point. When it flew over the area, it flew down towards the Elk River in another direction, and it crashed and hit a mountainside. That's where the police were going when Mrs. May reported the monster.
Mm-hmm.
Are you following it? It gets kind of confusing.
Yeah, well, we're starting to run out of time. We're almost out of time here.
So what we have is a basic search and rescue mission. The Flatwoods Monster incident was not one little isolated incident. We have incidents of UFOs crashing and landing all throughout the United States, and especially in West Virginia and Braxton County.
So do you get the idea that any of these craft were, did they all eventually somehow get repaired and fly off?
They worked their way out of the United States. And I'm going to say real quick, when I interviewed Colonel Dale Levitt, the head of the National Guard, he had received a call from Washington, D.C., and he was told to go up to two areas. One was the Sugar Creek area where one was seen, and the other one was Flatwoods. They didn't say what it was. The locals up there were calling them crash meteors, rockets, planes. They didn't know what they were.
Mm-hmm.
They were UFOs. And what was happening, Alejandro, is they were puddle jumping and landing throughout Braxton County. And I was able to track their flight path trajectories. The Flatwood ship took off of the Bailey Fisher farm. It flew into the Frametown area and crashed up on James Knoll. That is the incident where it happened the following night, where George and Edith Stutowski and their baby encountered the Flatwoods Monster partially out of its suit.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see those illustrations. And I talked to George Stutowski,
right,
and I researched that. So what we had was all of these ships, and I tracked them going back out over the United States too. And I was able to track them through Project Blue Book.
Mm-hmm. And to get back to what you were just talking about, because you have those pictures, is that it seems as though possibly that what Mrs. May and the children had seen was some sort of suit, that there was an entity inside of that hovering device. And then later on, the next day, someone had seen the top portion missing where this strange creature was standing with just the skirt part floating around.
Right, the lower torso.
Mm-hmm.
And like I was going to say earlier, and we jumped off track, talking about the beams coming out of the eyes,
mm-hmm.
Freddie May and Mrs. May said they were... This thing was in a dormant state. When they flashed the floodlights, the flashlights on it, May and Lemon, Mrs. May and Freddie said this thing lit up from the inside. It was basically like being on the inside of your car at night, and then all of a sudden you start your car up and all your dashboard lights and everything go on.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't beams from like a monster from a sci-fi movie. When this thing lit up, it was a craft. The inside of the craft lit up, and it forced the light out of the openings. The openings were portholes. Mrs. May and Freddie May said this thing, it was the head, the red area that was said to be a head was an inner helmet. The outer helmet was the part that came to like an Ace of Spades point, and there was a piece of some type of a clear like glass in front of it. It was a protective helmet. And the arms and claws were actually some type of antenna devices that were coming off of the shoulders. It wasn't a monster. Freddie said to Frank, he says, there was something inside of this thing. It was intelligently controlled. There was something in there. And probably the best way I could describe this is looking at a fighter pilot sitting in the cockpit of his jet. Okay, the cockpit area going across was the protective outer helmet, and this was actually an inner helmet inside, and something was looking through those portholes. When Satowski saw it the next day, this thing was floating and hovering, and he encountered the same sulfur smell. He got sick, and he threw up, and his car had stalled, and when he went out to see this thing that was hovering out in the woods, which, by the way, was oval too, he encountered this big, gigantic thing, and he said it was a good 9 foot tall. And from my drawings, the scale drawings of working with the witnesses, and they gauged its height by the branch of the tree that it hovered underneath in Flatwoods.
Mm-hmm.
It was about 12 foot tall. Snatowski said it was about 9 foot tall. If you put a 3 foot tall helmet over the top of this thing's head, 9 and 3 is 12.
Right. And you said he got sick, and Kathleen May and the children got sick also. Is that correct?
Right. Gene Lemon was vomiting because he was pretty up close to this thing next to Kathleen. He was vomiting from the sulfur smell. Satowski vomited right out there in the open area in Frametown where this happened. You have to remember, Frametown is where this thing touched down after it left Flatwoods.
Mm-hmm.
I documented it through the small little weekly papers where they told the thing was seen here, here, and here, and here. So I got my topographical maps from Braxton County, and I just pinpointed the thing followed the Elk River, and it flew up into another area where it was isolated, and people saw actually going over and crashing into that area.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why the police were so running around and a big flap. They didn't know what the hell was going on.
Right.
They were getting reports, and what they were actually doing is going back to the police headquarters. They would get another call, and they were going out to another crash. It was actually the same craft, the one from the south. And then we had the other one that crashed. Yeah, so what they were doing is they were puddle jumping, and the poor police were going nuts, going back and forth and back and forth. Colonel Levitt went up into the area later that night with 180 troops, he told me, National Guard troops that they were put out on call. It was an emergency. 180 troops went to the Elk River in the Sugar Creek area, set camp there. They were looking for something that was crashed that they were told was an airplane, but they never found anything. Levitt took 50 to 60 troops. He went back down the Elk River. He went to Flatwoods. They came in the backside of the farm, cordoned off that area, and he took samples from up there of what had happened. They knew what was going on.
Hmm. Was anybody able to examine Kathleen's dress?
The government agents came in undercover a couple of days after the incident, and I read about this in the book, and they scraped the oil out of her dress. An interesting part is these two guys that came in, they claimed they were magazine reporters, and Mrs. May didn't tell them a hell of a lot of information, and she told me that they came back again. These fellows came back again, and she said they said they were investigators from Washington. And when I said, how come they didn't tell you that the first time? She says, well, if they said that they were investigators from Washington, they knew we weren't going to tell them anything.
Right.
And she really didn't say a heck of a lot. And these guys came back, and they scraped the oil out of her dress.
Wow.
And they took it away with a special tool.
Interesting.
And Mrs. May said that one thing she very adamantly remembered is one of the investigators went down into the area across the backside of the little sloped area where the tree was, okay, where the encounter took place. And he came back a half an hour later, and she was shooting the breeze with this other guy, and they were standing there looking around at these big, gigantic track marks. She said when this guy came back over, he looked like a striped zebra from head to toe. They had on expensive suits. She said this one fella was covered with oil.
Hmm.
He was dripping from it because this thing was leaking and splattering as it sat up there near the tree when they encountered it. And she said he was just covered from head to toe. He looked like a zebra, and he was dripping with oil. And what's interesting is there was oil splattered and leaked all the way through these track marks. So this thing was obviously damaged.
Right. So you made a lot of incredible discoveries and headway on this case, it seems. And I think what's always been impressive about this case is all of these witnesses, and they've all stuck to their story throughout the years. And so that's what makes this just an amazing case.
Yeah, and here's in closing, here's a very important part of this whole story. From September 12th, which was a Friday, until the following Friday, that's when Mrs. May, Jean Lemon, and Ailey Stewart, the reporter who was the first one up there, and he's the one where I worked pretty close, he went up to the We the People show in New York. They all flew up there, and they did this show live, okay? When my illustrations came out with the correct versions, a lot of people were bashing my story, saying, oh, Ficino, he's a great illustrator. What a wild imagination. Why does this thing look so different? Why is it stray so far away from this monster-looking thing with a dress and the arms? Well, I did a little bit of researching, and I found out that there was an article called Braxton Monster Left Skid Marks Where He Landed, and it was in the Gazette, Charleston Gazette newspaper, on that Monday, which was the Monday 5 days prior to that stupid drawing being put on national television. And in that article, they said it left tracks. This thing looked like a mechanical man.
Mm-hmm.
And it wore a suit of green armor. There is the evidence that shows right off the bat that this thing they wrote is describing it as a mechanical man, and it looked like a warrior suit of green armor. And the article was special to the Charleston Gazette, and the guy who actually gave them the information was Ailey Stewart Jr., because he was the Johnny on the spot. He interviewed Mrs. May and the kids
right.
The following day.
Wow.
He was right on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
He was there at the house. He went up there that night, and he actually went up in a posse. This thing was pretty serious and scary. They went up there with a whole bunch of townspeople. He told me they were armed with shotguns, handguns. They had what he called electric lanterns. And
right.
When they got onto the spot, he said he was with a couple of the older boys. And
right. Yeah, I know there's a lot more to this story, but we're way out of time. Sorry.
All right.
So,
but they were scared to hunt for something that they didn't know what it was in the dark. So we can close with that.
Yeah,
point.
And of course, we can tell people, you know, there's a lot more in the book, so people have to check out the book. The book isn't out yet, but it'll be out soon, and they can go to flatwoodsmonster.com to read more about the story, to see these illustrations we've been talking about. And about when do you think the book is going to be ready?
The book should be out in about a week or so.
Great.
Yeah, and we're talking about a week, so... if you keep looking on the website, actually I have the book cover released, and if you go to my site, you'll see it, Alejandro, right on the top of the website page.
Yeah, and lots on the website. Pictures of all these drawings you're talking about, pictures of the witnesses, and a lot of information to read. So definitely enough at the site to keep people busy for a week until the book comes out.
Yeah, and a lot of new stuff I have in the book, and I got some really great stuff in there.
All right, great.
And
well,
thanks for having me on, man.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. It was really interesting stuff.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you to Mr. Fascino. I'm really excited about his book. I mean, it sounds really interesting, especially, you know, I don't know if anybody talking about how there were a lot of sightings the evening of this event. And of course his theory of possible recoveries and all this stuff. That's interesting. And I know there's a lot more in the book as far as series go. So flatwoodsmonster.com is his site. Otherwise, we are at the end of the show. Check out UFOdailynews.com. Oh, I did want to say thank you to a couple radio shows that have had me on lately. First of all, Spirits Among Us on Paramania Radio. It was really fun talking to you all. And my good friend Patrice Sheridan of A Global Focus. I spoke with both of them recently and had a lot of fun. So wanted to thank them as well. You all have a wonderful week, and we will be talking soon. Adios, muchachos.